Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the July 2026 issue. I'll resume reading a story that I had started last time titled Happy Fucking Birthday, An Exhausted America Turns 250 by Christopher Hooks. In this piece, the author is trying to determine whether he can recapture the warm and fuzzy feelings which he had about America during the bicentennial. His quest begins with a visit to the White House Visitor Center in Washington, D.C., at the America 250 Foundation set up by the United States Semiquincentennial Commission. His first interviewee is Rosa Rios, the chair of the commission. The author heads next to northwestern Pennsylvania to check out one of Freedom 250's Freedom Trucks, mobile museums funded partially with money appropriated from Rios' organization. As the story continues, the author is in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, with the Republican mayor, John David Longo, at the museum. The museum's material was offered up free of charge by the conservative Hillsdale College and PragerU, a right-wing outfit that offers demented civic education YouTube videos. The trucks themselves, Shirley explained, were staffed by Event Strategies. Dean Shirley, the proprietor of the trucks, explained, "We're staffed by Event Strategies, the company that staged the January 6, 2021 rally at the White House Ellipse, where the mob formed up before it went to ransack the Capitol, and which has racked up tens of millions of dollars in no-bid federal contracts during Trump's second term. The firm turns out to be one of the few real connections between Freedom 250 and America 250. In early 2025, the latter cut ties with a different event production firm more affiliated with the Democrats and signed new contracts with Event Strategies a few months later. Everything about the truck was half-baked, but each time I visited, it was packed. And when I showed up with Longo, he was frequently pulled aside by residents eager to express their gratitude. These people were hungry for some kind of substantive engagement with their country and its history. Not only the visitors. Thinking Shirley a company man, I asked whether he'd yet gotten bored of sitting in the truck. He turned gently reproachful. It's family history, he said. After lapping the exhibits a few times, I decided to see, up close, the largest flag in 130 square miles. I drove past the sheets, parked near the Taco Bell, and walked up the hill. From underneath, the flag was shockingly beautiful. It was a cold, cloudless, windy afternoon, and Old Glory was backlit by a setting sun. Its primary colors were 1,000 different shades. It was radiant and very loud. Every penny spent on this flag was worth it. Why didn't every city have one? The flagpole that Longo's administration debuted in July 2023 is 150 feet tall, made with Pennsylvania steel, sunk in Pennsylvania sandstone, and placed at the highest point in town, 1,400 feet above sea level. The flag itself is 40 by 80 feet and costs more than $100,000 between the installation and money set aside for future operating expenses. Like anything that's big for the sake of being big, however, the point is to make the observer feel small. The flag dwarfs the personal expressions of grief, celebration, and commemoration that are typically the point of a municipal park. I have become an angel in green and shall be a Girl Scout forever, read a nearby memorial stone. In a way, this moved me more than Antietam, but I could barely feel it for the thundering sound of cloth rippling overhead. I remembered also that when I'd seen flags this large in other countries, Ukraine, Mexico, I understood them to be an expression of insecurity and justified grievance rather than pride. Before leaving Slippery Rock, I spoke again with Shirley, who turned out to moonlight as an author of cross-country trip guides. He recommended a few stops on the way to Philadelphia, including an abandoned testing site for federally funded nuclear jet engine research, A quick Google search pulled up pictures of scorched bunkers covered in graffiti that read Death and Despair, and Reagan-Bush 84, and Centralia, the Pennsylvania town under which a coal mine fire has been burning since 1962. These also being dangerous temptations for a metaphor-making writer in a sour mood, I opted for a more direct route. What year is it? The last time I had been in Philadelphia was for the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Back then, I had been a Bernie bro, worried that Clinton couldn't win, and I spent most of my time there drinking with other party malcontents. But it was my first time being wowed by a convention in person, and the hype machine worked. Sometime between the celebrity-studded fight song, sing-along in prime time, and the balloon drop, I figured, it'll be fine. They've got this. That was an error of judgment. For centuries, Americans have looked to the city of brotherly love as our birthplace and come here to walk the same streets the founders did during the Revolution and early days of the Republic. Footnote 3. Soon, perhaps, they won't have to. The conservative Texas organizer Rick Green is hoping to build a replica of Independence Hall on a 177.6-acre complex at 1776 Patriot Way in Comfort, Texas, at the home of his Patriot Academy for conservative activists. The goal, he has said, is to free Americans from the obligation of going to Philadelphia, only to get shot. End of footnote. Accordingly, Philly has been a focal point of each milestone commemoration. The unofficial ones of 1826, the enormously successful centennial in 1876, the comically disastrous sesquicentennial of 1926, and the bicentennial, when the city's dysfunctional city government helped push the nation's focus onto Washington and New York instead. The city is in much better shape these days, but I had come to it looking for something it was not capable of providing. Footnote 4 is about the sesquicentennial of 1926. Everything that could go wrong at the sesquicentennial did. The centerpiece, for instance, was an outdoor stage production of Freedom, Man's Quest for Liberty, Through the Ages in 50 Tableaux, which employed 4,347 people, including a 1,000-voice chorus, a ballet troupe of 250, an orchestra of 125, and a menagerie of elephants, camels, horses, and papier-mâché dinosaurs. The first of the 50 tableaux recounted the battle for liberty that cavemen waged against the Tyrannosaurus Rex. The show was delayed or canceled at least 18 times on account of rain. End of footnote. This year, the main interest the federal government seems to have in Philly is as a playing field in the culture war. In January, the National Park Service removed signage at Independence National Historical Park detailing the apparent hardships that George Washington experienced as a slave owner in the city, having to rotate his chattel out of the city every 6 months, lest state law make them free, for example. In February, a federal judge ordered the displays reinstalled, but there have since been several more rounds of battle between the courts and the administrative state, and the matter is not likely to be resolved by the 4th. Meanwhile, the state of Independence Mall itself was surprisingly shabby. When I visited, the Liberty Bell was being displayed in a cheap wooden shelter while a new roof was being built, and parts of the Independence Hall complex were closed for renovations. Congress Hall, the two-story building where the legislature met for a decade, was also closed so that a fire suppression system could be installed. A Philly resident told me that even the grass on the mall is brown and unhealthy for most of the year, and the National Constitution Center, on its north side, is little more than a field trip destination. The government's goal is to get the highest profile buildings shipshape in time for the 4th, but that's really the latest possible deadline for what could have been years of investment and much bigger aspirations. It would be reasonable to expect that Philadelphia, as the origin point of the richest and most braggadocious country in the world would be a kind of national shrine. Although America is much richer, there's no real comparison between the historical infrastructure of Philly and that of Paris, the launching point of the other great 18th century revolution. It is difficult to imagine the French allowing a situation like that at the first home of the Franklin Institute, a marble building from 1825 that was once the home of Philadelphia's History Museum, but is now a fenced-off ruin with hypodermic needles littering the back garden. Last year, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that thieves had pried off a bronze plaque dedicating the building to the history of Philadelphia from its main entrance. The National Park Service, keeper of Independence Hall, has long tried to draw attention to the lousy condition of the buildings here. A radical reimagining of this part of the city would cost a fraction of the $200 million the Pentagon asked for in an initial supplemental funding request for the Iran War. But the modest renovations and upgrades completed this spring are likely the end of things for now. On the Mall, I watched a veteran member of the NPS delight a small child with a talk he gave every half hour in front of the closed Congress building and thought about the kind park rangers I'd met in the past week. A sort of uniformed monk class trusted with preserving historical meaning in a country that doesn't particularly value it. There might be a lodgment here for some kind of patriotic feeling, I thought, but then I remembered something I'd read in the news recently, and a quick search confirmed that the administration is shredding the NPS, which lost 24% of its permanent staff in the first 5 months of Trump's second term. Increasingly desperate for something to latch onto, I recalled an unlikely patriotic memorial that had cheered me in the past much more than it really should have. The Find a Grave webpage for the tomb of Thaddeus Stevens, who, from 1859 to his death in 1868, represented a Pennsylvania district in Congress. Stevens was born in 1792, less than 4 years after the ratification of the Constitution, and grew up in a society formed in the wake of great violence that was questionably democratic, if not outright oligarchic. But Stevens possessed an absolute, unshakable conviction that he had been put on earth to ameliorate the condition of the poor, the lowly, the downtrodden of every race and language and color. He was responsible for protecting the existence of the state's controversial public school system in its earliest years. He was a club-footed, stern, cranky abolitionist, a conductor on the Underground Railroad, and a radical Republican. He might have had, as some whispered, a common-law marriage with his black housekeeper. During one House debate in 1862, when a California congressman condemned the spread of Chinese labor in his state, Stevens, who possibly had never met a Chinese person in his life, rose to thunderingly affirm the nobility of China's sons and daughters and assail the deprivations they suffered at the hands of degenerate and cowardly European opium traders. He was a recognizable contemporary figure, the most annoyingly earnest and hardline left liberal you know. Despite being a powerful member of Congress during the second founding, he isn't much remembered outside of Pennsylvania. So I was surprised to see, on the Find a Grave site, more than 200 comments left over the course of 25 years by Americans who had somehow learned about Stevens and been moved by his legacy. Sometimes they attached to their comment a little flag GIF, and sometimes took his side in political debates that had been defunct for 150 years. "You were right to impeach Andrew Johnson," wrote Frank N. in 2001. If it can feel a little vertiginous to remember the kinds of people with whom I presently share a country, it means something to remember the kinds of people the country has produced at its best, and to know that other Americans feel the same way. I did not have to worry about loving the whole. I left Philadelphia for nearby Lancaster, where Stevens is buried. On the side of his tomb is a final polemic. I repose in this quiet and secluded spot, not from any natural preference for solitude, but finding other cemeteries limited as to race by charter rules. I have chosen that this I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life. And then, in larger letters, an inscription that seemed considerably more valuable than the ones in Washington, Equality of Man Before His Creator. Stephen's death was in some ways a blessing. He wouldn't live to see Reconstruction end and was spared the fury of knowing what the next century would hold. He could say in his final congressional speech that such large steps have lately been taken in the true direction that the patriot has a right to take courage. But this was accompanied by his final verdict on the matter. Man still is vile. To note that man is still vile, though, is to leave open the possibility that someday man might not be, which is to say that it could be a kind of patriotic sentiment. Across the street from the tomb is an elementary school in the system that he helped preserve, where a fresh-faced and racially diverse group of kids was lining up. The anger Stevens felt about his country's unrealized promise had been good for America. My own anger didn't feel particularly useful, and standing in the graveyard, I had a hard time listing reasons to take courage, given that most of what I valued about America seemed to be in decline or was otherwise under sustained attack from the country's worst people. But I had at least answered for myself the question of how susceptible I might be to false sentiment when the fireworks are set off in July. There was perhaps not much more than a strain of the country's history that I could embrace, and it was often the strain of beautiful losers. There are many worse things, though, than being a well-meaning crank. Stephen's kind of patriotism seemed both more honest and more enduring than what had been previously offered to me on the road. So if I make it to one of America's block parties this summer, and I hear Coolin' the Gang, Yahoo, it's a celebration, this is what I will be thinking, and with a warm heart, man still is vile. Christopher Hooks lives in New York. Now a short piece titled Bunker Buster, from a speech delivered by Percival Everett at the Authors Guild Foundation Gala in April. I'm a storyteller, and I'm going to go off script and tell you a story if you don't mind. This is dedicated to Carla Hayden. Where is she? And it takes place in the Library of Congress. I call it PC, post-Carla, or PI, post-intellectual. And we have a newly installed librarian appointed by someone whose name I choose not to use. And a woman who comes into the library is looking for books on history. And she walks up to this, let's call him Hegsy, and she says, where are your books on history? And he says, the books on history have been moved. They're in a bunker in Anacostia. That's where we keep them now. But we have other books. We have books by Ayn Rand over here. And we have a number of copies of this one book about, I think it's making a deal. She comes back several minutes later and says, where are your books on history? And he says, madam, I told you the history books are in a bunker in Anacostia. You can fill out a request and maybe you can get in to see them at some point. He helps someone else. She comes back. Where are your history books? And he becomes upset and he says, ma'am, can you spell dog as in dogmatic? She says, yes, I can. D-O-G. Can you spell cat as in cataclysmic? She says, I can, C-A-T. And then he says, can you spell fuck as in history? She says, there is no fuck in history. And he says, that's what I have been trying to tell you. Next up is an essay titled American Ephemera, A Primer on a Free People's Government by William T. Volman. An explanation. What dimensions has our America? I propose to offer you this antique measuring stick with a few of my own prejudices rudely cashed in. Just because the founders said it hardly makes it so. Moreover, just because I have read some of them here and there hardly proves that I understand them. 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the Supreme Court's longest-serving Chief Justice expressed sour expectations of my abilities. "Those who follow us," wrote John Marshall, "will know very little of the real transactions of our day, and will have very untrue impressions respecting men and things. Such is the lot of humanity." Indeed, it is. Picking through his relics, I uncover one such disarticulated real transaction dated 1788. He told us that the principal danger arose from a government which, if adopted, would give away the Mississippi. Tucking that item back into its coffin of irrelevance, I rake through kindred ephemera, hoping for something to serve our day. For although Marshall could hardly foresee my real transactions, maybe it will suffice that he loved the Constitution, hoped it would endure while fearing it wouldn't, and did his best to operate its checks and balances with impartial fairness and benevolence, a government of laws and not of men. By men, he meant white men, who ideally would be Christian property owners. He owned slaves, whose humanity he acknowledged without opening his eyes to their rights. He married his Polly, loved her until the end, trusted her advice, but never thought her fit to vote. Well, the world changes. What else can it do? "It is not for the dead to give laws to the living," remarked John Quincy Adams. "Prospective legislation upon the most uncertain of contingencies is the broken column and mutilated inscription of eternal Rome." But since an array of brave, well-meaning, and often divergent minds consider the bad blood between Marshall and Thomas Jefferson, with whom John Adams also feuded, could construct a triple-walled fortress of coherence in which our freedoms could dwell, and since, in this 250th year since 1776, the house still stands, improved by amendments and, thanks to its separation of powers, only partially corrupted, then I say the founders built awfully well, at least for me. If I were black or a woman, I might feel less grateful. All the same, they introduced the notions of equal rights and equal representation, leaving to us, as ancestors will, the task of making their house less imperfect. They knew the lot of humanity, the slime within us, for it was in them also. Consider George Washington conniving with William Crawford in 1767. It is possible that Pennsylvania customs will not admit so large a quantity of land as I require to be entered together. If so, this may possibly be evaded by making several entries to the same amount. But this I only drop as a hint, leaving the whole to your discretion. The other matter just hinted at is to join you in attempting to secure some of the most valuable lands in the king's part, notwithstanding the proclamation that prohibits the settling of them at all, for I can never look upon that proclamation in any other light, but this I say between ourselves, than as a temporary expedient to quiet the minds of the Indians, and must fall, of course, in a few years. I quote this here because elementary school propaganda renders the founders impossibly good. Hence, we of average wickedness might fear we will pollute instead of save what they bequeathed us, government by the people and for the people. "To form a new government," Washington advised his brother, "requires unbounded attention, for if the foundation is badly laid, the superstructure must be bad. Every man should consider that he is lending his aid to frame a constitution which is to render millions happy or miserable." In their construction, I was rendered happy. Like Benjamin Franklin's alter ego, Silence Duguid, I lived a cheerful country life, spending my leisure time either in some innocent diversion with the neighboring females or with the best of company, books. Sometimes I ventured downstairs to the rotten places where the founders had not built as they should have. With Frederick Douglass for a faithfully angry lantern, I gazed on Lincoln with admiration, pity, disappointment, and gratitude. That was how I lived my cheerful country life. I published books that sometimes offended people and made up my own mind, just as Jefferson would have counseled me to, about God, suicide, abortion, the Senate, foreign policy, and climate change. I voted, paid my taxes, and fulfilled my jury service. I roamed our states from Alaska to West Virginia. The longer I studied our Constitution, the more I loved it, because our system is my home. I have loved America most for what she has sometimes tried to be, what she pretends to be, and what she might have been. Thanks to her, I grew up believing I had rights. Yes, her faults are ugly, but so are mine. And since hoping that I will be better tomorrow than I was today is my favorite way of lying to myself, let me keep on hoping. In its dynamic equilibrium, our system sways like a grand old tree in the wind. Now, though, some branches are breaking off. No justice will be attainable, predicted John Adams, should we inflict on ourselves a government of corrupt choice. This we have done. Adams again. Nor will innocence or virtue be safe in the judicial courts, but for the friends of the prevailing leaders. Legal prosecutions will be instituted and carried on against opposers to their vexation and ruin. No favors will be attainable but by those who court the ruling demagogues. I watched the president's attempts to punish his enemies with lawsuits, investigations, and extortions. His threats to Greenland because he didn't get a Nobel Prize. His gleeful deportations of American citizens. If and when America dies, I suppose we will continue on, bustling like beetles between her bones. I used to assume she would outlive me, because she was supposed to live forever. Now, just in case, let me kiss her goodbye. The founders believed her mortal situation typical of most governments and may be inevitable, in which case I ought to resign myself to it. But since they keep building, compromising, and repairing, I will go on excavating advice from them and from those who followed in their wake. Of course, they would be disgusted by some of our innovations, for instance, gay marriage. Even that radical tolerator Jefferson proposed that a woman found guilty of sodomy be spruced up by boring through the cartilage of her nose a hole of 1/2 inch in diameter at the least. Worse yet, to simplify their meaning, as I necessarily must, is to approximate and therefore to raise up perils of misapplication. But we are already in trouble. So let's reread Madison. Why stand around waiting for the Constitution to cave in? With so many of my fellow Americans now expressing fearful, angry helplessness, I turn to the past for guidance, chuckling at John Quincy Adams' fiery sarcasms, marveling at how simultaneously with his sleazy peculations, George Washington grew into greatness, I think because he never sought it. Loving Thomas Jefferson's revolutionary optimism, sorrowing with Lincoln over disunion, he too was a founder of sorts, for the Civil War necessarily aggrandized the executive into the Union's juggernaut. Wondering how many other times the Constitution has already almost died, observing the ever-altering isometric tensions of checks and balances in our fort, which Lincoln called a house divided. Envisioning my best America as improved from the best Americas of people more expert and noble than I. On the one hand, the citations you are about to read can be consoling. This too shall pass. On the other, so might America. John Quincy Adams, 1796. A sullen gloom hangs upon futurity. If, as I suspect, all three branches of government are corrupted, America's best hope lies in her people, included and excluded. Some of them will now speak to you about the machinery of our system, how it was built, tested, and sometimes sabotaged, and how we might repair it still. I have organized their judgments not by chronology, but by theme. Wherever they more or less coincide, I take confidence that the idea of America is coherent in that place. For instance, no taxation without representation. Where they differ, I see faction, unsettled and possibly unsettleable moral questions, questions literally settled to the death, and the intellectual freedom that is the glory of individualism. And when someone disagrees with himself over time, I see either an evolving opinion or opportunism. Whether or not you agree with whatever I make of their hopes and errors, perhaps you will at least match your prejudices against those of the Americans who whisper up at you from the ground. They may help you make peace with low expectations, or recognize the sounds of despotism in the rafters, or inspire you to fight back, or pour yourself a shot of bourbon and mutter, "What a goddamn shame." Here in Fort America, the walls creak, then something smashes onto the roof. Gazing up at the watchtowers, I wonder how many of them have been abandoned by their sentries. We, the people. People have always been more apt to fight for the sake of mutual defense and the furtherance of profit schemes than for some inchoate utopia. These first citations demonstrate how the idea of a United States of America enlarged itself gradually out of practical expediencies, with the entire continent contested between France, Spain, Russia, and Great Britain. Some thought the latter's narrow strip of 13 colonies might be safer in a kind of one-for-all and all-for-one proto-NATO. Hence, such loyal Englishmen as Benjamin Franklin proposed a simple confederation against the French and their Indian proxies. The mother colony did not assent. Militia commanders were already feeling slighted by their British overlords, and London's stranglehold on trade and manufacturing caused still more resentment. Next came the matter of taxation. Parliament was self-destructively arrogant in declining the colonies any vote or even much pretense of a say. Thus, the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, and the Boston Tea Party and its punishment, which led to Bunker Hill and the Revolutionary War. You are listening to readings from the July 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Some Sounds of Arizona. Now the Americans saw more need than ever to unite. They no longer imagined themselves created equal to their British counterparts, who did possess some degree of representation and were not disdained as oafish colonials. But what local powers must be surrendered to the insurgent American collectivity? With their first effort, the Articles of Federation, they hoped, as do the rest of us, to have their cake and eat it too. They made policies that could be defied at will, their central government being toothless. That was why, after defeating the British, they called a constitutional convention. What happened then was right out of John Locke. Mutually distrustful people in a state of nature finally took heed of their perilous weakness, swallowed hard, and gave up some sovereignty in exchange for safety and, so they hoped, liberty. Considering, moreover, that one principal encouragement to the French in invading and insulating the British American dominions was their knowledge of our disunited state, and that from hence different colonies were, at different times, extremely harassed, we came to a unanimous resolution that a union of the colonies is absolutely necessary for their preservation, that it is essential to English liberty that the subject should not be taxed but by his own consent, or the consent of his elected representatives. Benjamin Franklin, 1754. How bold and enterprising the enemy have grown! How unconfined are these ambitious designs of the French! And how much it will be in their power, if the colonies continue in their fatal lethargy, to give a final stab to liberty and property! Nothing I more sincerely wish than a union to the colonies. George Washington, 1756. Nature has put bounds to your abilities, though none to your desires. Britain would, if she could, manufacture and trade for all the world. So selfish is the human mind. But 'tis well there is one above that rules these matters with a more equal hand. He that is pleased to feed the ravens will undoubtedly take care to prevent a monopoly of the carrion. Benjamin Franklin, 1764. The Stamp Act, imposed on the colonies by the Parliament of Great Britain, engrosses the conversation of the colonists, who look upon this unconstitutional method of taxation as a direful attack upon their liberties. George Washington, 1765. To the printer, the colonists being greatly alarmed by news of the act for abolishing the legislature of New York and the imposition of new duties professedly for such disagreeable and to them appearing dangerous purposes, began seriously to consider their situation. Benjamin Franklin, 1768. Addresses to the throne and remonstrances to Parliament we have already proved the inefficacy of. How far, then, their attention to our rights and privileges is to be awakened or alarmed by starving their trade and manufactures remains to be tried. George Washington, 1769. The more the people are dissatisfied, the more rigor will be thought necessary. Severe punishments will be inflicted to terrify. Thence, the British nation and government will become odious. War ensues, and the bloody struggle will end in absolute slavery to America, or ruin to Britain by the loss of her colonies. Benjamin Franklin, 1771. We assert our rights, or submit to every imposition that can be heaped upon us, till custom and use will make us as tame and abject slaves as the blacks we rule over with such arbitrary sway. George Washington, 1774. So inscrutable is the arrangement of causes and consequences in this world that a twopenny duty on tea, unjustly imposed in a sequestered part of it, changes the condition of all its inhabitants. Thomas Jefferson, 1821. Article 1. The name of the Confederacy shall henceforth be the United States of North America. Article 13. The Union thereby established is to continue firm till the terms of reconciliation proposed in the petition of the last Congress to the King are agreed to, but on failure thereof, this Confederation is to be perpetual. Benjamin Franklin, Proposed Articles of Confederation, 1775. Unhappy it is, though, to reflect that a brother's sword has been sheathed in a brother's breast. But can a virtuous man hesitate in his choice? George Washington, 1775. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The Declaration of Independence, 1776. Let all distinctions of nations, countries, and provinces, therefore, be lost in the generous contest. George Washington, 1776. The jealousy, envy, and avarice incident to our nature were, for the time, in a great measure smothered and rendered inactive, while the deep-rooted principles of hate and the powerful motive of revenge, instead of being turned against each other, were directed exclusively against the British nation. Abraham Lincoln, 1838. The good sense and good dispositions of the people, as soon as they perceive the incompetence of their first compact, instead of leaving its correction to insurrection and civil war, agreed with one voice to elect deputies to a general convention. Thomas Jefferson, 1821. We now stand an independent people, and have yet to learn political tactics to form a constitution that will give consistency, stability, and dignity to the Union, and sufficient powers to the Great Council of the Nation for general purposes is incumbent upon every man who wishes well to his country. George Washington, 1783. There never was a government without force. What is the meaning of government? An institution to make people do their duty. James Madison, 1788. It was to be, in the first instance, a government of accommodation as well as a government of laws. Much was to be done by prudence, much by conciliation, much by firmness. George Washington, 1790. It is of infinite moment that you should properly estimate the immense value of your national union to your collective and individual happiness, that you should cherish a cordial, habitual, and immovable attachment to it, accustoming yourself to think and speak of it as of the palladium of your political safety and prosperity. George Washington, 1796. That our government should have been maintained in its original form until now is not much to be wondered at. It had many props to support it through that period, which now are decayed and crumbled away. Through that period, it was felt by all to be an undecided experiment. Now, it is understood to be a successful one. Men of ambition and talents will continue to spring up among us. They will naturally seek the gratification of their ruling passion. Can that gratification be found in supporting and maintaining an edifice that has been erected by others? Most certainly it cannot. Abraham Lincoln, 1838. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. Abraham Lincoln, 1863. For I do not conceive that we are more inspired, have more wisdom, or possess more virtue than those who will come after us. The power under the Constitution will always be with the people. George Washington, 1787. They, the unpeople. All men are created equal, but does our system treat them so? America's Indian policy has entailed centuries of fraudulent treaties and mass murder. During World War II, the internment of Japanese Americans in concentration camps was smiled on by the Supreme Court. Korematsu versus United States, 1944. The intimidation and violence against striking Latino farm workers by the Texas Rangers and like-minded legal functionaries were disallowed in Ali versus Medrano, 1974. But the field workers I interviewed in the Imperial Valley at the turn of the millennium were still doing work that I wouldn't and couldn't do. Semi-legal toil, and therefore accompanied by unpaid hours, miscellaneous fees, insufficient breaks, etc. Although women's suffrage became the law of the land in 1920, the Equal Rights Amendment was never ratified. The following citations relate to the abuse of Black Americans whose enslavement was slyly written into the Constitution. My purpose here is not to condemn poor America herself, but our continued failures to honor her by respecting one another. These passages highlight the typically human cruelty and hypocrisy of fighting for one's own liberty while denying it to one's neighbors. They also show that humans can sometimes redress such injustices, however provisionally. Without quite sharing the sentiment, but wishing I did, I refer you to Margaret Fuller's optimism that if men are deaf, the angels hear. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, 1787. No gentleman within these walls detests every idea of slavery more than I do, and I ardently hope that the time will soon come when our brethren in the southern states will view it as we do. But to this we have no right to compel them. Two questions naturally arise. If we ratify the Constitution, shall we do anything by our act to hold the blacks in slavery, or shall we become partakers of other men's sins? I think neither of them. Each state is sovereign and independent to a certain degree, and shall we refuse to eat or to drink or to be unified with those who do not think or act just as we do? Surely not. Whether those in slavery in the southern states will be emancipated after the year 1808, I do not pretend to determine. General William Heath, 1788. I was struck with surprise when I heard him express himself alarmed with respect to the emancipation of slaves. Let me ask if it will not be a usurpation of power. I believe such an idea never entered into any American breast. James Madison, 1788. The men who framed this declaration were great men, high in literary acquirements, high in their sense of honor, and incapable of asserting principles inconsistent with those on which they were acting. They perfectly understood the meaning of the language they used, and they knew that it would not in any part of the civilized world be supposed to embrace the Negro race, which lay by common consent, had been excluded from civilized governments and the family of nations, and doomed to slavery. Dred Scott versus Sanford, 1857. With this letter comes a Negro, Tom, which I beg the favor of you to sell, and any of the islands you may go to, for whatever he will fetch. I shall very cheerfully allow you the customary commissions on this affair, and must beg the favor of you, lest he should attempt his escape, to keep him handcuffed till you get to sea, after which I doubt not but you may make him very useful to you. George Washington, 1776. With respect to the other species of property, I do not like to even think, much less talk of it, were it not that I am principled against selling Negroes as you would do cattle in the market. I would not, in 12 months from this date, be possessed of one as a slave. George Washington, 1794. In proportion to the greater ignorance or wickedness of the people to be governed, laws must be more severe. The majority of Negroes are of a plotting disposition, dark, sullen, malicious, revengeful, and cruel in the highest degree. Benjamin Franklin, 1770. I am glad to hear that the disposition against keeping Negroes grows ever more general in North America. Several pieces have been lately printed here against the practice, and I hope in time it will be taken into consideration and suppressed by the legislature. Benjamin Franklin, 1772. Slavery is such an atrocious debasement of human nature that its very extirpation, if not performed with solicitous care, may sometimes open a source of serious evils. Benjamin Franklin, 1789. Franklin owned slaves, but eventually freed them. In 1769, I became a member of the legislature by the choice of the country in which I live. I made one effort in that body for the permission of the emancipation of slaves, which was rejected. Thomas Jefferson, 1821. Nothing is more certainly written in the Book of Fate that these people are to be free, nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Thomas Jefferson, 1821. A song supposed to have been written by the sage of Monticello. You call her slave, and pray were slaves made only for the galley? Try for yourselves, ye witless knaves, take each to bed your Sally. Yankee Doodle, who's the noodle? Wine's vapid, tote me brandy, for still I find to breed my kind a negro wrench the dandy. John Quincy Adams, 1802. Be assured that no living person wishes more sincerely than I do to see a complete refutation of the doubts I have myself entertained, and to find that in this respect they are on a par with ourselves. Hopeful advances they are making toward their reestablishment on an equal footing with the other colors of the human family. Thomas Jefferson, 1809. I have seen no proposition so expedient on the whole as emancipation of those born after a given day, and of their education and expatriation after a given age. Their amalgamation with the other color produces a degradation to which no lover of his country, no lover of excellence in the human character, can innocently consent. Thomas Jefferson, 1814. At the end of his life, Jefferson freed 5 of his slaves. Slavery is one of the foulest stains on the character of Christendom. In the United States, the trade itself is sufficiently execrated, but the disposition to expel slavery from our bosom does not, I think, gain strength in the South. John Marshall, 1827. I would add that slaves, though property, are also persons. Although incapable of exercising the right of suffrage themselves, why may it not be exercised for them by that active part of the society which exercises the same right for others equally incapable of acting for themselves? Females, minors, and sea are excluded from the polls, but are included in the enumeration of persons on whom representation is apportioned. John Marshall, 1829. Marshall's will manumitted 1 chattel, the rest continued in bondage. It was asserted that we were a ragged set crying for liberty. I reply to it, the whites who have so long and so loudly proclaimed the theme of equal rights and privileges, that our souls have caught the flame also, ragged as we are. I have come forward and made myself a hissing and a reproach among the people, for I am also one of the wretched and miserable daughters of fallen Africa. Maria W. Stewart, 1832. I can but die for expressing my sentiments, and I am as willing to die by the sword as by the pestilence, for I am a true-born American. Your blood flows in my veins, and your spirit fires my breast. Maria W. Stewart, 1832. No person held to service labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up. United States Constitution, Article 4, Section 2, 1787, nullified, 1865. But it will be owing only to your labors and the fearless efforts of those who, trampling the laws and constitution of the country under their feet, are determined that their hearths shall be, spite of the law, an asylum for the oppressed. Wendell Phillips to Frederick Douglass, 1845. I confess I hate to see the poor creatures hunted down and caught and carried back to their stripes and unrewarded toils, but I bite my lip and keep quiet. It is hardly fair for you to assume that I have no interest in a thing which has and continually exercises the power of making me miserable. You ought rather to appreciate how much the great body of the Northern people do crucify their feelings in order to maintain their loyalty to the Constitution and the Union. Abraham Lincoln to Joshua Speed, 1855. I believe we have no power under the Constitution of the United States, or rather under the form of government under which we live, to interfere with the institution of slavery, or any other institutions of our sister states, be they free or slave states. Abraham Lincoln, 1859. A careful reconsideration of the subject convinced me that the Constitution of the United States not only contained no guarantees in favor of slavery, but, on the contrary, was in its letter and spirit an anti-slavery instrument demanding the abolition of slavery as a condition of its own existence as the supreme law of the land, Frederick Douglass, 1881. What I would most desire would be the separation of the white and black races, Abraham Lincoln, 1858. All persons held as slaves within said designated states are and henceforth shall be free, and upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. Abraham Lincoln, Emancipation Proclamation, 1863. It was a great thing to achieve American independence when we numbered 3 millions, but it was a greater thing to save this country from dismemberment and ruin when it numbered 30 millions. Lincoln, alone of all our presidents, was to have the opportunity to destroy slavery. Frederick Douglass, 1892. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, or any place subject to their jurisdiction. 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, 1865. Though the national independence be blurred by the servility of individuals, though freedom and equality have been proclaimed only to leave room for a monstrous display of slave dealing and slave keeping, still it is not in vain that the verbal statement has been made, all men are born free and equal. There it stands, a golden certainty, wherewithal to encourage the good, to shame the bad, and, if men are deaf, the angels hear. But men cannot be deaf. It is inevitable that an external freedom, an independence of the encroachments of other men, such as has been achieved for the nation, should be so also for every member of it. Margaret Fuller, 1844. We have run out of time, so next week I will continue this article, covering the subjects of checks and balances, our freedoms imperiled, and resisting despotism. Thanks so much for joining me today for this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the July 2026 issue. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.